This is the podcast of AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. AK is a weekly show that presents the stories and sounds of Alaska's characters, cultures, and current events. AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alaska Humanities Forum.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue, Dillingham, Sitka,
Chugiak, Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell, Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaska-Narechamir. From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, we travel here and there, from the AFN convention in Anchorage to the wilds of the Alsek River, plus the story of how two Southwest Alaska villages came to be.
I checked with the Department of Education, and they said, well, the only way they could have a school there would be if people all lived on the island so they didn't have to cross water.
That and more coming up on AK from APRN. Welcome to AK. I'm Jessica Cochran. This year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention honors natives who have served in the military. A Veterans March opened the annual event. Alaska Territorial Guard vets led the way as the U.S. Air Force Band of the Pacific played the Alaska flag song. Many Alaskans who served their country in times of war live in remote rural areas and lack the financial resources for travel to urban-based health services. As AK's Ellen Lockyer reports, efforts to help underserved veterans are ongoing, but are seldom enough.
They may have been bent with age, but the surviving members of the Alaska Territorial Guard stood tall in the eyes of welcoming conventioners during the opening moments of this year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. Men like Paul Kayuna of Kipnuk were youngsters when the conflict of World War II reached Alaska's shores.
We had a tough time, you know, alert 24 hours a day. Long time ago. Cold in winter time, you know. Now it's getting warm. Not like in the old days anymore. In the ATG, we have a hard time to communicate with the Army. I'm the only one that's a communicator for the ATG.
He says his job was to look for and report airplane noises or unusual objects on the beach during a time when communications were rudimentary at best and snafus, like the time a shipment of rifles went to the wrong village, were common. Alaska natives served the military during Korea, Vietnam, and most recently, Iraq. But when many are discharged, they return to remote villages, and even though they are due federal veterans benefits, they don't always get them. Jerry Beal says it's the Federal Veterans Administration's job to keep track of vets.
But for them, you know, it's about numbers and dollars. And they're satisfied that they have health care within 75 miles of 80% of Alaska's veterans.
Beal heads the state's Veterans Affairs Administration. He says health care is available in village clinics, but for treatment of serious or ongoing illnesses, travel to the city is the only alternative.
Whenever you talk about underserved, any of our people living in rural Alaska compared to the amenities that are in urban Alaska, they don't have the same access. They don't have the same road structure. They don't have the ability to come to a doctor. Some of the people in remote villages, whether they're veterans or not, have a hard time getting the health care that they need, especially if they're elder or especially if they have an advanced or chronic condition. And that really forces them in many cases to leave a rural setting and move into an urban area.
Beal says the mission of both federal and state agencies is to serve vets. State veterans' services include housing loans, land discounts, tax exemptions, educational benefits, even free hunting licenses and ferry passes. But when it comes to health care,
Alaska doesn't even have a veterans hospital. We do have a joint agreement or a joint arrangement between the VA and Elmendorf Air Force Base with DOD. And we use Elmendorf as our emergency room even because the health care facility in Anchorage is only a clinic.
In these times of extreme fuel prices and astronomical air airfares, cash-strapped village native vets simply cannot afford to fly to Anchorage or Fairbanks. Some people are trying to remedy that. Mo Bailey, who heads Veterans Aviation Outreach, is a Vietnam vet who is using his flying skills to make sure vets in need get the help they deserve.
Most of the native veterans, they can normally be seen by the village nurse or health aide, but sometimes they have problems that warrant a trip into Anchorage. And if they're not in the system, they have to pay their own way or get an organization such as ours to bring these guys in, and we do get numerous calls for assistance.
His gleaming red, white, and blue Piper Cub, a frequent sight in villages in southwestern Alaska, makes about 4 trips a month to bring ailing vets into the Anchorage area. Bailey says 70% of the vets the nonprofit serves are Alaska Natives.
These people are not tracked. Once they leave the military, they go out to the bush. They're off the radar screen. They are not tracked. They have no clue of new laws that come out about education or any other benefits. They have no clue.
Bailey says most of his organization's work is aimed at locating lost veterans and bringing them into what he calls the system. A good many veterans in the bush have medical problems, and if they are not in the Veterans Administration records, they can't get benefits they are entitled to.
I've seen a lot of people die and leave their families with enormous debt because of medical problems that, had they known the benefits that they were entitled to, they wouldn't have incurred that financial loss.
Bailey says the outreach tries to make information about benefits available to the veterans it serves, and state service representatives can be contacted in Fairbanks, Wasilla, and Anchorage for free help about entitlements. Discharge from military service can bring on a whole new set of challenges and adjustments, but that fact does not daunt active National Guardsman Homer Nanura.
To me, it was heartfelt. I would do it again, go on another deployment. As part of my duty as a service member, and just like any other veteran, I'm pretty sure they'd be willing to do it again, too.
Nanurak is just back from Iraq and Kuwait, where he worked security detail. He marched with the men and women of the military into the convention hall Thursday morning, saying the appreciation from AFN made him feel good. Veterans health care tops this year's convention agenda. The national group Veterans for America this month released a report indicating the challenges facing Alaska's Army National Guard are daunting, and that many guardsmen have been deployed and redeployed despite the shortage of care and treatment on their return. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
We'll hear more from this year's AFN convention later in the show. But first, we'll head out on our weekly trip around the state. Today on 300 Villages, we visit Heidelberg in southern southeast and False Pass, just past the tip of the Alaska Peninsula on the Aleutian Chain's first island.
My name is Anthony Christensen. I live in Heidelberg, Alaska. Heidelberg, Alaska is located on Prince of Wales Island. It's in the southern part of the Alexander Archipelago. The nearest city is Ketchikan, Alaska. It's about 48 air miles away from Heidelberg. Well, they have an extensive road system here, but first you have to fly into Ketchikan, Alaska Airlines, and then you have to take the inner island ferry system to Hollis. And then you have to catch a car ride 45 minutes to Heidelberg. Population in Heidelberg is 350 people. Heidelberg actually was a consolidated village of Klinkwan, Halkan, and Sequan. And the Haida people back in 1911 voted to consolidate for the purpose of education in Heidelberg and to build a school and some other things that would bring the people closer together so they could get services. High cost of groceries is the main challenge we have, high fuel cost, and dwindling job availability. Logging is kind of dying out right now, so that's putting a lot of people out of work. I enjoy living in Heidelberg because of the accessibility to the natural resources. It's a subsistence-based lifestyle here that makes up a majority of how we complement our income and stuff is by having the resource available. So that's the number one reason I like to live here, besides the fact it's probably the most beautiful place on earth.
My name is Melanie Hoblett. am the city clerk for the city of False Pass. False Pass is located on Unimak Island. It's the first island of the Aleutian chain just off the peninsula, and we are approximately 650 miles southwest of Anchorage. The name False Pass comes from an Aleut word. The story is somebody named it False Pass because they thought larger boats could not traverse the northern channel of the pass because it was too shallow. But now that we have the Coast Guard in here every year checking buoy, so, you know, everything but the largest vessels can go through False Pass. The winter / permanent population of False Pass is 40 to 45, and summer population is close to 100. Like all communities, we are struggling with the cost of fuel and trying to make sure that we have deliveries on time. We recently, along with help from a regional corporation, installed a wind tower at the city office as a test project to see if that's a viable energy source for us.
We heard from Anthony Christensen in Heidelberg and Melanie Hoblett in False Pass. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Ever wonder why Denali, the mountain, is still called Mount McKinley, by the federal government anyway? According to one story, it's related to a struggle hundreds of miles away in the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea. When we get back after the break, we'll hear the story of the day the federal government pulled out of the Pribilofs after running the fur seal industry there for 70 years. Larry Merkulieff grew up on St. Paul Island and was involved in the negotiations that kept the community alive. He recalls when they first learned the federal government role there would be ending.
In 1980, when Reagan took office, very shortly after he took office, he wiped the Pribilof Island program out of his budget. That's when the first time we realized that there was real trouble occurring and that we had to take this very seriously. But it was done unilaterally, and that would have wiped out the Pribilofs. But we went to Senator Stevens and asked him, you know, can we get $5 million to buy us a year to negotiate the withdrawal of the federal government off the island? So he said, well, go through the president's budget and find anything in there that's dedicated to Alaska and bring it back to him, and he'll consider it. And so what we found was $5.1 million in the president's budget to change the name of Mount McKinley to Denali. And so we went to Stevens, and Stevens said, well, you know, this was proposed by AFN, so you need to see them get their okay to release the funds. So we went to the Alaska Federation of Natives, and they said, well, Doyon and Atna, two regional Native corporations, were the ones that really supported that. You need to talk to them. So me being the Native leader, I went to them. And to make a long story short, they agreed to release the money. And for that reason, to this day, Mount McKinley wasn't changed to Denali.
More on St. Paul Island after the break. Welcome back to AK. On October 28, 1983, the federal government pulled out of the Pribilof Islands for good. For the previous 70 years, the government had run a profitable fur sealing operation on St. Paul and St. George, using the Aleuts who lived there as the workforce. For much of that time, the Aleuts lived in slavery-like condition. They were paid in kind, could not move freely on or off the islands, and were treated harshly by government agents. By the 1970s, Aleuts on the Pribilofs had gained civil rights and could expect good pay and benefits for their work. But public sentiment had turned against fur in general, and against killing seals in particular. The industry was no longer lucrative, and the government decided to pull out, with little warning and no planned transition. It was a crisis. Fur sealing was the only industry, the only economy the island had known for 200 years. No one was sure how they would survive. Larry Merkulieff was one of the leaders on St. Paul who helped to reshape the community. He told APRN's Annie Feit that the night before the pullout, community leaders held a meeting, and he convinced them they should hold a commemorative parade marking the federal government's departure. So the morning of the parade, he waited at the start in his truck, with the town's lawyer and a reporter along for the ride.
When I got down there was no one there. And I thought, well, okay, we'll just wait. You know, so we waited and waited, and nobody showed up. Finally, after about an hour after the parade was supposed to have started, no one had showed up. I said, well, what the heck? We'll do a one-person parade, one-car parade. Maybe other people would join us. Well, just before I did that, then a man that I grew up with showed up. His name was Anthony Malvidoff, and he came down to take out the fire truck. So now we're two cars, the fire truck and myself, and my truck. And we waited for another half hour. Nobody showed up, so we decided to go on the parade. But about a quarter mile into the parade, I think there was a four-wheeler that came in and a pickup truck and even a bicycle, somebody had a bicycle. And it's all, okay, great. And we kept going, and more people started coming in with their vehicles, either with their four-wheelers or three-wheelers or their trucks. And even the, unbeknownst to us, all the young kids had come together and made placards, signs, saying things like, you know, Alliates are survivors, or we shall overcome. I don't know how they got that idea, but all these kids were on these pickups holding up these placards. In fact, I'll show you a picture of one of those. Hang on for a second. So you can see here is a picture of these young kids with one of these with a sign that says, Alliates are survivors, no, Alliates are forever. And before I left the island, they gave me this picture, and on the bottom it says, for Larry, remember. And that was just, you know, couldn't be a more perfect and beautiful gift for me when I left the island. Because it really does, it's like how our people got through this is a testament to the spirit and will of our people, and that's my ancestry. And I'm very proud of it. Our people are remarkable people. And so we went through the parade until all these vehicles showed up. But I still wasn't sure whether or not we had it until something very inexplicable, different happened. And that's when the elders came out. And some of the elders were waving white dishcloths. And some were banging pots and pans. And all were hollering, Homer gone, Homer gone, Homer gone. Everywhere we went in the village, in the parade, all these elders who had understood that particular period of time, who were alive at that time, did that. But the thing was, what's inexplicable about it is they never talked to each other about it. They just like all spontaneously came out and did the same thing. And I thought, that's the miracle that I was looking for. You know, I know now we're really going to make it. Because what the elders were doing was remembering a time back in the 1920s when the government agent at the end of the sealing season, when they would finish killing seals, would leave the island on a vessel called the Homer. And of course, once the government agent left, the whole island celebrated. And unbeknownst to the government agent, people were waving white dishcloths, banging pots and pans and saying, Homer gone, Homer gone, Homer gone. So everybody was free. And that's what the elders had brought back. And of course, everyone there had heard the story before about Homer gone. And so most people understood it, and that really buoyed up, I think, the spirit of the people. And plus the fact that we were all there together, all 500 of us, you know, every woman, man, and child. In that parade, the entire village honking horns, hollering, showing these placards, you know, hollering Homer gone. And I knew at that point that my people, at a very deep level, knew that they were going to make it. And that was really what brought it out, because what happened afterwards was nothing short of a miracle. We turned around the community within less than half a generation. We went from zero economic base to $34,000 per capita. We retooled from a government-run company town to private enterprise literally overnight. It was a remarkable, remarkable thing. I don't think any community in the United States has ever gone through anything like that and have mobilized this in that way and in changing, you know, 200 years of a way of dealing with things in 10 years. I mean, that's remarkable.
Larry Merkulyev spoke with APRN's Annie Feit at his home in Anchorage. St. Paul eventually became a base and processor for fisheries in the Bering Sea. But high fuel prices have hit the Pribilofs hard, and both communities are still struggling. Everywhere in rural Alaska, energy costs are taking a huge toll, not only on the pocketbook, but also on the traditional social structure of villagers. The Alaska Federation of Natives is looking for solutions to the rural energy crisis with this year's annual convention. As AK's Ellen Lockyer tells us, the problem has gone on for years, but it's getting worse.
This year, the problem reached the breaking point.
They used virtually all the money they had.
I mean, look at Anchorage. They're paying over $4 a gallon. That means we're going to be paying close to $6, maybe even over $6 by the end of the summer.
We've been having a tough time this year. Shallow water. We couldn't make it to McGrath, so they got shorted up there.
The city has ran up a large bill, over $320,000, to our fuel supplier.
Alaska Natives living in the bush are facing a serious energy crisis. The price of gasoline topped out in Alaska this summer somewhere short of $5 a gallon in the urban areas, but in bush Alaska, it was much more. Matt Gilbert lives in Arctic Village.
We're one of the few villages where we're really, really off the beaten path. We have an extremely hard time with fuel. Gas is like gold up there because it runs out so fast, and you better use what you can before it runs out. You better use it to get your wood and get your water. A couple of times I was in a situation where I had a half, like 2 gallons, and I said, okay, I could either use that to get water, because I need water to live, or I could use it to fuel my chainsaw to cut my wood to stay warm tonight, you know, and but hope that these 5 blocks of wood are going to make it to the next 2 days when the fuel comes. And that's a case study for you of what we're going through up there.
Gilbert says gasoline costs more than $8 a gallon in Arctic Village. Bethel area legislator Mary Nelson says the special legislative session this summer resulted in some forward progress, notably the $1,200 per person energy rebate that got tacked onto permanent fund checks this year. But that money is soon spent and fuel costs continue to soar.
You know, how can a young family afford to heat their home in a community where stove oil can be, you know, the average is $6 a gallon in the villages that I represent.
$100 a barrel oil prices this year filled state coffers, but devastated cash-strapped villages at the end of the distribution chain.
They have been suffering in silence. And what's interesting is that the people who are screaming the loudest are paying the lowest amount in the state. You know, we are very concerned about those villages, and they, like I said, are really suffering in silence and bringing it to legislators.
Nelson says the social impacts of the fuel costs are disturbing.
The prices are so high that I am very nervous about village sustainability.
Ralph Anguson lives in King Salmon. He says he's witnessing the social impacts of the energy crunch.
You know, a lot of our people are leaving the area, you know, because the villages, you know, can't afford the high price of fuel.
Some village families are using the energy rebate to relocate to Anchorage and the Matanuska Valley. Nelson says the next legislature will have to continue to find answers to the energy problem to keep too many natives from moving. Arctic Village's Gilbert says with gas prices shooting toward $9 a gallon where he comes from, it's time to find alternatives.
Future dependence on fossil fuel is really unwise. I've been trying to talk everybody, Yukon River Watershed, all the known like entities that service our community. I've been really trying to talk them into investing in in-stream turbines or biomass.
Both Nelson and Gilbert participated in energy panel discussions at this year's convention. For AK, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Thoughts and deeds have left us dry. Shadows on the trail behind us. All that's left to do is cry. Tears are flowing like this river.
The founding of a village is usually an organic process hidden in prehistory. But in Alaska, the settlement process is relatively new, and stories of these beginnings are sometimes close to the surface. They seem to often hinge on the decision to build a school. Johanna Yurick stumbled on two such tales in southwest Alaska.
Alaska Natives never intended to build a village in Aleknagik. In fact, Aleknagik is Yupik for wrong way home. Most natives in that part of Bristol Bay lived up the Nushigak River, not on the short Wood River, which flows out of Lake Aleknagik and into the Nushigak.
They would start up the Nushigak when summer was over, and evidently foggy or something, and then they would end up going up the Wood River, which is this place here. Well, when they started up there and they realized that it was the wrong way home, they kind of had a little a campsite, and they called it Aleknagik.
Roly Moody was 12 in 1931 when he first saw what would become the village of Aleknagik. Members of his family were Seventh-day Adventists from Washington State looking for a way out of the Depression in the 30s. The first Moody to arrive was Josie, to teach school at the orphanage at Kanakkanak. She met and married Frank Waskey, a former territorial representative who ran a dog team up to the Bethel area delivering mail. The two decided to build a cabin at the far end of Lake Aleknagik. She wrote her relatives, the Moodys and Smiths, suggesting that they too should move north and live off the land. By 1935, the migration of the six or seven interrelated families began what was to become Aleknagik.
It was called Mosquito Point over here.
The name Aleknagik became official when Mabel Smith, Roly's aunt, chose it for the post office.
Because she was the first postmaster.
Her granddaughter, Carolyn Smith, the only Smith still living on Mosquito Point, has a copy of the journal entry Mabel wrote when she decided to choose for the name of their community the word natives spoke when they arrived at the lake by mistake. The journals written by various family members indicate that life was hard in the early days. For example, on a day she felt, quote, poorly, Josie Waskey did not stay in bed. Her husband had mushed off to deliver mail, so she got up, gathered berries, checked traps, butchered meat, cooked, and baked bread. When her relatives arrived, the work didn't stop. There were cabins to build and food to put up for winter, but that was the least of it. Life was fragile, as Roly Moody discovered when he was 13, just after he arrived in Alaska, when his dad and older brother went on a routine trip down the Wood River for supplies.
They went down to Dilling, or they called it Snag Point, you know, to get some things for winter supplies and stuff. Well, on the way back up, it was at nighttime, and their boat hit a tree that had kind of fell off of the bank, and it turned the boat over, and they were drowned.
The Moodys and Smiths built a log school for their children. The territory paid Josie to be the school teacher, and the family settled, starting barge operations that would later be sold to what is now Crowley Maritime. They built the mission school through their church for Native students, and many Native families moved nearby. Aleknagik is now a Yupik village with a small city council, Native Village Corporation, and tribal group. Long after Aleknagik was established, Diane Carpenter went up the Kuskokwim River with her husband and children to homestead at Stony River Island, the site of a small trading post they bought.
I had just had a baby 6 weeks before, and I also had a broken leg. So we went up there. I was on crutches and started building a cabin. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and it was absolutely horrible. The only reason we didn't give up was because our friends said we were going to be back when the first snow flew, and we were determined to prove them wrong.
After 4 years of work, the cabin was less like a Chinese laundry for diapers and more comfortable. It was the early days of statehood, and the Stony River Trading Post became a sort of community center, with people from up and down the Kuskokwim River stopping by.
The people came to us and said they were very sad because they had to send their children to Wrangell Institute when they were 8 years old to go to school. And I was just shocked. They lived all the way up and down the river. I checked with the Department of Education, and they said, well, the only way they could have a school there would be if people all lived on the island so they didn't have to cross water.
The people got together and decided to incorporate a little town on the island where the carpenters homesteaded. They laid out a town site, giving everybody a five-acre plot. The Bureau of Indian Affairs paid for nails, tar paper, and windows.
So everybody worked together, went out and got logs, and everybody helped everybody else build cabins. So everybody got a cabin without any mortgages or anything. It was wonderful.
They built the log school and teacher housing. Carpenter then got the Division of Aviation to put in an airstrip and got a small generator installed. She became the village mayor and postmistress. She kept the trading post operating, took weather observations, and ran the village generator. She still remembers one cold night when her husband was gone.
Kathy was, I don't know, about 9 at the time, and Lisa was 5. So we got dressed quickly and had to go out to the light plant shed. And Lisa held the light. It had this huge crank that weighed about 20, 25 pounds. So enormous flywheel. And so I cranked it, got it going. And then I said, okay, Kathy, you get it up to speed after I've got it going, and then I'll flip the switch. And so she got it going faster, but she forgot to take the crank off. And then we were in this little shed, and it could have flown off of there any time. If it hit any of us in the head, that would have been the end. So I got them out of the way, and I was able to reach over and grab it and pull it off. At least we got the light plant going again. If we had not gotten that light plant going right away at 40 below, it would have been a disaster for the whole village.
Diane Carpenter went on to help create the Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. She now lives in Anchorage, but around 60 people still live in Stony River, the village she started. I'm Johanna Urich.
After the break, dodging icebergs on a Southeast Alaska float trip.
At one point, we were going 14 miles an hour in a raft. that's fast.
Stay with us. You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Jessica Cochran. Every summer, about 80 groups float through remote wilderness north of Glacier Bay, down the Tatsanchini and Alsek rivers. Disaster struck 2 raft trips this past summer. A skilled rafter from Idaho and his son died after getting thrown from their raft in June. A few days earlier, a calving glacier sent a wall of water through another group's campsite. Possessions and boats were scattered, but no one was hurt. These incidents are rare, but as K2OO's John Ryan tells us, the risk is always there.
The sun shines on a small clearing in the aspens and spruce along the Tatsanchini River, near the southwest corner of the Yukon Territory. Outfitters Kate and Stan Bohr of Haines are helping our small group get 2 inflatable rafts ready for 10 days of no turning back travel. From here, the Tatsanchini flows into the Alsek River. The Alsek punches through the world's tallest coastal mountains to enter the Gulf of Alaska. Mostly, the Bohrs are teaching us the meticulous art of securing hundreds of pounds of food and gear onto the rafts.
Especially for the canyon, we want to strap these into place for these boxes to keep them from moving around. And again, we're going to have bags on top of this, too. You can use a blue one there and just feed it.
On each raft, we build a waterproof jigsaw puzzle of dry bags, ammunition cans, coolers, and buckets. Then comes Stan's safety talk on the 140 miles of what he calls extreme wilderness that we're about to travel. Hypothermia, icebergs, capsizes, grizzlies.
And maybe the only other thing is the fluctuating river. It has a tendency to go way up and way down in a short amount of time at any time of day. So make sure you have your boats well tied up.
The midday sky turns dark and fat raindrops start to pelt us. Bohr warns us that we'll enter a canyon and the worst rapids of the 10-day trip just about a half hour after we start.
Your biggest nemesis are canyon walls, and you'll see as soon as you enter it, it's really sharp rocks. You just really can't hit the walls or you risk putting a hole in your boat. And that changes the whole complexion of the day.
Except when it's flooding, the Tat is not an especially fierce river. It's fabled among river rafters because of its scenery and wildness, not the whitewater thrills. Our party of four Juneau residents and one friend from Seattle sets off. Two of us have rafted the Tot before. Four of us are wearing dry suits, and we've all got life vests on. The river decides not to rise anymore that day, and we manage to make our way through the rapids unscathed. At the Shawshe Meadows put-in point, the Tatshenshini is a modest-sized river, less than 100 yards wide. The jade-green waters give no hint of the radically different river just a few days float away. Where the landscape isn't vegetated, it feels raw and naked. So new, it hasn't found its angle of repose. Boulders and gravel tumble without warning. Raw glacial creeks pour into the Tot, invisible boulders clacking downstream in the muddy current. Each creek adds to the river's flow, and the Tot keeps growing. 3 days in, it's half a mile wide. You can travel for days at a time here without seeing any signs of human activity, let alone any other people. But we happened to overtake a group of rafters from Idaho. Freelance photographer and avid river rafter Glenn Oakley of Boise says down south, there's nothing like the Alsek in either size or speed.
At one point, we were going 14 miles an hour in a raft. That's like, that's fast. That's ripping. And when stuff's coming at you, when you've got to make decisions way in advance, because otherwise you're going to end up in a place you may not want to be.
About 80 miles into the trip, we float across the invisible border back into Alaska. The Alsek is now 2 miles wide. It feels more like an ocean than a river. At one point, you can see 24 glaciers in every direction. The mind boggles to comprehend the scale. River runners here call it sensory overload syndrome. On a river this wide and fast, we know we have to pick our route far upstream to get to shore at any particular spot.
On most whitewater trips, you pull over and hike downstream a bit to scout any big rapids. But on the Alsek, you scout for icebergs. We've pulled over near the end of a peninsula that juts out into the entrance to Alsek Lake, which is covered in icebergs, and we're scouting down to see if there's a pass through that won't be choked with icebergs. The narrow passage through the lake is called the Channel of Death, so we're going to check it out to see if it's passable or whether we're going to have a long portage.
Trip organizer Julie Scheuer of Juneau sees an unwelcome, if not unexpected, sight in the lake.
Yeah, all the ice smashed against the knob. It's not just smashed up against it, it's like piled up on it.
Unfortunately, we also get our first glimpse of our potential portage around the lake. Through the binoculars, it appears an apartment building-sized iceberg is blocking our plan B out of here. So we hike to the end of a peninsula for a better vantage. Kevin Hood of Juneau thinks there might be a passage through the icebergs that we can't quite see.
There may still be a way. This is a huge volume of water going, and it's just hard from this slanted perspective.
Yeah. But it's like a maze.
I'm not willing
to get stuck in the middle of a bunch of icebergs.
Dissension in the ranks, so we hike to a small hilltop for another perspective. We see that apartment building of ice isn't actually blocking our back channel portage. So instead of pushing our luck with the towers and slabs of ancient ice in the Channel of Death, we decide to push the rafts overland. We get back in the rafts and head to the mostly dry river channel that bypasses the iciest parts of Alsek Lake. We unload the rafts and scour the riverbanks for long, smooth pieces of driftwood. They'll work as primitive rollers to get the heavy rafts across a quarter-mile portage. Now it's time to earn our safety with some hard labor.
One, two, three!
Two hours later, we've got all the gear back in the boats. We row around the corner to the last campsite of our 10-day trip and a well-earned rest. We sit by the fire, look out toward the forked tongue of the Alsek Glacier, listen to icebergs rumble and crack, and savor the adventure stories we'll have to tell later on. For AK, I'm John Ryan on the Alsek River.
Roll, mighty river.
roll on, let it rip and roll on, let it rip and roll on. I've got a notion you'll go to the ocean alone, let it rip and roll on, let it rip and...
Skateboarding was a big topic in Petersburg this fall. Public safety concerns prompted the city council to expand rules for skateboarders who use city streets and sidewalks. Skaters felt singled out, and their testimony led the council to ease some of the proposed restrictions. While the debate was still underway, Matt Lichtenstein stopped by the town's small skate park to learn more about the sport from some of the kids and adults who love it.
It's after school on a Thursday, and several kids and adults are taking advantage of the sunny weather and taking turns on the ramps at Petersburg's small skate park. Like most sports, it's got its own language.
That's a rock and roll, rock the fakie, fakie tail, rock the fakie, fakie feeble. It's kind of like old school.
19-year-old Stephen McDowell describes some of his friend Will Coffey's tricks.
They call skating backwards fakie. So, like, left foot forward is regular, right foot forward is goofy. But if you're regular and you're going goofy, call it fakie.
McDowell and Coffey, who's 23, serve in the Coast Guard in Petersburg. Skating's a way for them to have fun and blow off steam while they're in port.
So we skate here every day it's not wet from the rain and whatnot, so it's a fun little skate park.
The frequent southeast rain blows under the park's high roof, soaking the metal ramps, platforms, and cement pad, and that makes it difficult, if not impossible, to use, and the moisture can damage wheel bearings. But on a nice day like this, McDowell says the park can draw quite a crowd.
There were about 22 kids here the other day, and they're all having a good time.
Ten-year-old Justin says he comes to the skate park every day after school, rain or shine, and he's been skating about a year. His favorite trick's called a kickflip.
You slam your back foot down, slide your front foot up, and the board pops up in the air. And then to do a kickflip, you do that, and then you slide off your foot off the side of the front of the board, and it goes into a spin, and then you're still in the air when the board's spinning. And then it spins, and like every time it spins, it's either like I can land a single, but I know people that can do triples, and it spins six times and then they land it.
How'd you learn how to do this?
I just practiced.
The tricks can be complex and the falls can be painful, and on this particular day, just a couple of kids wear helmets or pads. Cena Martinez is one of them.
I like to skateboard just because it's nice and fun, and it's like a hobby to me. And I like watching other people skateboard.
But I see that you're real safe. You're wearing a helmet and elbow pads, and that's probably saved you a few scratches and bruises, huh?
Yeah. I just started skateboarding this year, so I want to be really protective of myself.
Most of the kids at the skate park on this particular day are elementary or middle schoolers, teens like the park too, but it's pretty limited, and many skateboarders like taking their sport to the streets and sidewalks as well. That's resulted in concerns from some drivers, like Ann Lesh. A near collision with a skateboarder this summer prompted Lesh to raise the issue with the mayor, and she weighed in this fall as the city council considered a new ordinance on skateboarding.
I've talked to countless adults who have had near encounters with kids just coming out of the blue. One adult said they had been driving on, I think it was 8th and Haugen. And it was, I don't know, around 7 o'clock. And a kid just came shooting out in front of them. And, you know, that's my fear, is that someone is going to be killed.
Skateboarding was already banned on the road and sidewalks of Main Street. The new ordinance expanded that ban to more of the downtown area. It also put some restrictions in the sport on other city streets. Skateboarders thought the original measure was overkill.
My name is Matthew Garrett, and yep, I'm putting on my skateboarding shoes and taking the insoles out of my work shoes and putting them in my skate shoes because I'm old.
Matt Garrett skateboards for fun, and he drives a truck for his landscaping business, but he started out with that business years ago using a skateboard to get himself and his equipment from job to job.
I ended up borrowing some money from my father to buy a Thatcher, and the Thatcher could be taken apart, and all the pieces would fit in a garbage can, and I'd put my rake and my broom and my tarp in the garbage can and put it on the nose of my longboard.
Garrett's has been a sort of informal advocate for local skateboarders, especially during the city council discussions. After extensive testimony from Garrett's and many younger skateboarders this fall, the council ended up approving a significantly different ordinance. They removed a rule that would have prohibited skaters from using the driven portion of all city streets. Instead, they opted to require skaters to follow the same rules as bicyclists on streets where skating is allowed, a change that Garrett's appreciated.
I think the last challenge would be to, you know, convince the council that as far as the streets that are marked off downtown, you know, the kids are capable of skateboarding just as responsibly as those kids who are allowed to ride bikes. I think that would kind of make all the kids feel vindicated, but I just think it was a success because the kids could actually see right before their very eyes the law changing, you know, in their favor.
The skaters' testimony this fall not only had an impact on the final ordinance, it also convinced at least some of the counselors of the value of the skate park and the need for improvements. For AK, I'm Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg.
And that's AK for this week. We had help from John Ryan in Juneau, Johanna Urick and Julia O'Malley in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. While you're there, sign up for our podcast, check out our archives, or send us an email to let us know how we're doing. You can also email us directly at ak@aprn.org. AK's Ellen Lockyer reported from Anchorage this week, and Scott Burton from Juneau. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. Our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Jessica Cochran. Join us again next week for part three in our series on the anniversary of Alaska statehood.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.